The Monocle Quality of Life Conference returns, and this time we're touching down in Zurich. Join Monocle's editors and a lineup of tack-sharp panellists for lively debate, informed conversation, and top-notch hospitality from the 28th to the 30th of June. Find out more and book your ticket now at conference.monocle.com.
Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on the programme. The city has often been seen as a place where bad things happen, especially crime. And while many cities are still the backdrop against which murderers, robbers and fraudsters act out their criminal pursuits, they've actually become surprisingly safe in recent years. So this week we'll find out why violent crime rates have been dropping in the US and why nobody can give you a simple explanation for the shift. And as we focus on the world of the emergency services, we'll ask, are you in tune with how they sound? All that, plus that misdemeanour, riding on public transport with no ticket. That's all coming up over the next 30 minutes, right here on The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck. We'll start the programme in the US. The country has been witnessing a sharp decline in urban crime. The level is currently at its lowest since the first half of the 20th century. So what's behind it? Well, the drop has proved both unexpected and difficult to explain. In a recent piece in The New Yorker, the writer and essayist Adam Gopnik laid out some of the key elements that have led to this change. And it's not all down to mass incarceration, or as he puts it, the moral scandal of America. Adam joined me from New York a bit earlier. Adam, what you describe as the great crime decline, a phrase that has been coined before which you use, it seems that you feel that it was a series of coincidences that brought about this decline rather than one single act. In the past, people have talked about the broken windows policy being responsible. But is your feeling it was just a coming together of a whole series of events?
I wouldn't call them coincidences so much as they were contingencies. By that, I mean that they were all directed at the same end. It wasn't just a question of chance. A lot of different people, a lot of different groups, working in lots of different ways to try and, in plain English, fight crime. There were community groups who were working to take back blocks and then whole neighborhoods. There was new methods of policing, including variations of broken windows policing, some of them extremely aggressive, involving stop and frisk and some of them much more tactful, to use a word, that essentially involved flooding neighborhoods where crime happens before the crime could happen. And then there were lots of other smaller changes. There were the flood of young people, 20-somethings, the kind of the Seinfeld flood, coming back into the cities and staying there into their 30s, where a generation before they would have left for the suburbs still in their 20s. So all of those small waves happening together are, I think, the best explanation we have right now for why crime stopped and then declined so dramatically.
And tell me, the thing you talk about there, the policing, the stop and search policies used mostly or quite often against young black men in urban areas. Your piece is fascinating because most things you read don't look at this darker side of it, this more complicated side, which is that many people ended up being incarcerated, and yes, the crime rates came down. But you point out that in New York, the police have kind of backed away from that belief that incarceration is the only solution, and still, the crime rates haven't really fluctuated. They've remained at historical lows. So is your feeling that maybe it helped at the beginning, but now we can change the policies and address some of the issues that organizations such as Black Lives Matter talk about?
Yeah, well, first of all, I should make it clear, it's not so much my feeling. I'm no expert nor intuitive about these things. What I was trying to do in that piece was to summarize the best social science that's been done, particularly drawing on a guy at NYU named Patrick Sharkey and another guy at the University of California at Berkeley named Franklin Zimmerich, who I think have done the best work or the best work summarizing other people's work on these questions. Stop and frisk was a kind of ugly outgrowth of zero tolerance or so-called broken windows policing, which said basically that you couldn't ignore small civic problems because they would always grow into larger civic problems. And one interpretation of that, or one way of thinking about that, was to say, well, you stop people on the street before they can commit a crime. And the police tended to latch on to black teenagers, basically, and harass them, in plain English. What is striking is exactly that, that as that policy over the last 5 years here in New York has been reduced or in many respects completely eliminated, that's shown no effect on the continuing decrease in crime. And more broadly, incarceration, which became the moral scandal of America, the number of men incarcerated in America, the number of black men incarcerated in America was at its peak greater than the number of black men in slavery in America in 1861. Incarceration has begun to go down. Here in New York, it's gone down dramatically, and it's had no effect on the crime decline. That is to say, crime has continued to decline. So all the evidence seems to suggest that you can continue to have positive social change, that is, less and less crime, without having the noxious side of over-policing. And let me add something, too, because I think it's very important. It's the point that Patrick Sharkey makes over and over again. People who benefit most from the decline in crime are the most vulnerable people. In plain English, rich people can buy their way out of crime. Poor people can't. And yet what you see is as crime declines in any particular neighborhood, the test scores, the grades, the school performance of the kids in that neighborhood shoots way up because the tension, the fear, the stress of living in a high crime neighborhood gets eliminated. So we can't underline enough how much the crime decline benefits the most vulnerable and least privileged people in our society.
Sharkey's data and the data you talk about may sit in a kind of a social sciences world which feels reasonably independent, but both sides of the political argument have latched onto this debate and used it in different ways. But also it felt from your survey of the evidence being tripped up by a little bit. So on the right, for example, we have Donald Trump and his supporters saying, or supplying rather, images of the city which are more reflective of the 70s and 80s, saying these are still dangerous places where we need to wrest back control and change the way of policing. On the liberal side, you have people saying, actually, the reasons these cities got better was because of nice gentrification and things, and being a little bit unsure how to deal with the fact that actually maybe the numbers did shift because of some brutal policing as well. Do you think that both right and left are finding it difficult to find a narrative from those statistics which they can accept and sell to their audience?
Yes, I think that puts it well. I'd amend it a little bit. It seems to me that on the right, at least on the Trumpite right, you have a plain and quite brutal exploitation of fantasies. You know, just as anti-immigrant sentiment tends to be strongest in the UK in places where there are the fewest immigrants and least strong in places where immigration is accepted, immigrants are familiar. In the same way, in the United States, fear of crime is often greatest in places where it doesn't take place, not in urban centers, but in exurban and in rural places. That's what Donald Trump appeals to. And as I say in the piece, he waves the bloody shirt of urban crime in places where it never took place as a kind of memory, a kind of folk memory, if you like, of something that's now largely vanished. And so I think that the right-wing exploitation of crime that is no longer in any sense a crisis reflects that ability to blind people to reality. On the left, there are two different things I think that are going on. On the one hand, you have people who are glad to see crime decline, but uneasy, as you say, about the way it was done. And I think those people need to pay more attention to the reality that you can have dramatic reduction in crime without the noxious sides of mass incarceration or even the lesser noxiousness of stop and frisk, for instance. And at the same time, you need to recognize, as I was saying a moment ago, the kind of left-wing myth that over-policing or that the fight against crime is something that benefits only the privileged is a pernicious myth. As I said a moment ago, the fight against crime benefits above all the most vulnerable people in the population. I do think that we need to see that both things are possible. In other words, that it's genuinely possible to see a reduction in crime without additional police harassment and without additional incarceration. That's what all the numbers, that's what all the statistics indicate very clearly.
And what was your view when you interviewed people and you looked at the evidence about the other thing that seems to trouble the left, which is this notion of gentrification? You're correct that, of course, in many of the communities where people are bedeviled by shootings and crime, they're the people who get the biggest gain. But there are also many communities where that shift in perception meant that college kids, for example, who may have lived on the edge of a city, now wanted to live downtown. Families came back to the city core. And there, it seems, again, there's a little bit of a kind of a difficult story because, yes, everyone likes their neighbourhoods to look better. But as you describe some of these neighbourhoods that are becoming now like yuppie dorms, is there a tension around that we don't quite know how to use to our benefit the gains from the drop in crime?
Sure. I mean, look, I've spent a lot of time in the last 10 or 15 years bemoaning in my writing in the New Yorker magazine the monoculturalization, if that's a phrase, of New York, the flattening out of the diversity and variety of kinds and of neighborhoods that was such a wonderful feature of New York when I arrived here almost 40 years ago. I think we're all concerned about that. At the same time, we mustn't be sentimental about the New York that's passed, about the high crime New York that we've lost. We all benefit from the change. Patrick Sharkey in his book makes the case, and I think has the numbers to show that it's so, that gentrification is a highly visible process when we see it, but it's actually not nearly as pervasive as we imagine that it is. That is to say, the transformation in the character of neighborhoods is not, in New York at least, is not nearly as widespread as we think it is. Much more a function of immigration, the transformation of neighborhoods in New York. That is, numbers of people coming from Asia, particularly into New York, rather than rich kids displacing poor people, if you just look at what actually has happened. Having said all that, I will say pugnaciously and defiantly that anyone who can remember New York of the 1970s, when it seemed as though the city was simply going to shut itself off, the city was seemed ungovernable and seemed to have no future. As I remember when I moved here, very much the shock of and dismay of my parents in Canada, it's much better to have the problem of too many people wanting to be in the city than the problem we had before, which was no one wanting to be in the city, cities being abandoned. I'd much rather have cities overpopulated and the ills and distresses of affluence rather than the ills and distresses of abandonment, which is what we were living with 40 years ago.
And finally, as I say, you look at all this incredible evidence from the world of academia, but there's another nice element that you bring into this story, which is why the TV series Friends is a bit of a signifier for change in the city and the change in the crime rate. Perhaps you could just explain that for our listeners.
Friends and Seinfeld, I think I cite them both. Well, you know, right after 9/11, when the city was in a state of panic and despair, I happened to go for a long walk with a real estate tycoon who I happen to know, a fellow Canadian. And I said to him, "Are you worried about the future of New York?" He said, "Not a bit," he said, "because the key number for understanding the future of cities is the median age of childbearing, when you have your first child." He said, "As long as people are, as a rule, having their first kid at 30 rather than at 20, as they used to, they will never abandon cities. Because when you're in your 20s and you're in a city, all you're doing is looking for a mate, and terrorism and anthrax and crime, nothing will drive you out of the city. Sex rules over everything else." And in a very unselfconscious way, that's what Friends and Seinfeld demonstrated. They were shows about young people who were prepared to put up with a great deal of what their parents would have viewed as inconvenience in order to remain in the center of a city trying to get laid, in plain English. And that phenomenon, though it was presented in a comic way in those shows, I think was a genuine sociological fact, that the flood of young people coming to the city and staying in the city by sheer numbers, because the best analgesic against crime is eyes on the street. The more crowded streets are, the less crime you're going to have. So that by sheer numbers of overcrowding of the Phoebes and the Georges, I think that had a significant effect on the crime picture as well.
That was the writer Adam Gopnik on some of the highlights from his feature for The New Yorker, The Great Crime Decline. Here's this week's commentary. It would be nice to be a policeman. Well, for one day. For a start, you would definitely be under arrest. And I would nab anyone who dropped any litter, especially anyone who threw a cigarette butt out of a car window or lobbed an empty can. I would arrest all the drivers using their mobile phones as they poodle about the city. And I would also arrest the woman I saw stealing the salt and pepper grinders off an al fresco restaurant table and jail the oiks I saw hotwiring a scooter. I would take in for questioning the people who swear at their children or tug their dogs aggressively. And I'd have a word with people who push on the subway. And on a bad day, I would just lock up anybody I disagreed with. Life in the city is a whirlwind of interactions and snatched images. And while some of these may rank as annoyances, a few are real crimes. In London, where robbers on mopeds snatching mobile phones has become a common crime, I've witnessed two of these attacks. The second one happened just in front of a car I was travelling in, and for an instance, I wondered why we didn't just knock them off their bikes. Their deaths, my jail sentence, were obvious reasons not to take this course of action. But the attack made me understand how people quickly become vigilantes. What I did actually do was, well, nothing. I just went on with my day. Low-level crimes, crimes where nobody actually gets hurt, are even, in our safer cities, often disregarded as part of the territory, unless they directly impact you. So, instead of becoming vigilantes or amateur policemen, we let these events pass us by. But in the end, I'm sure that's much better than trying to intervene, because then it's hard to know when to stop. And don't give me that look, because you, for one, are going behind bars for a very long time. Now, thousands of people in Belgrade commit a crime every day. Commuters and shoppers in Serbia's capital city jump on buses, trams and trolleybuses unencumbered by a travel card or any intention of buying a ticket. Inspectors are supposed to keep passengers honest, but they've got very little power to prosecute or even punish. Here's Monocle's Balkans correspondent, the Belgrade trolleybus regular, Guy Delorney.
Here in Ljubljana, getting on the bus is an orderly affair. Passengers board at the front and place their Urbana cards on a reader next to the beady eye of the driver. Nobody would dare to break bus etiquette by jumping on through the rear or middle doors. Well, only an ignorant newbie, perhaps. But let's say I managed to persuade the driver of this bus to take me from Slovenia to Serbia. I'm afraid he'd be in for a commuter culture shock of double-decker proportions. Jumping on a Belgrade bendy bus is a total free-for-all. Four sets of doors open at once, and passengers pile in and out at will. There's an electronic terminal next to each door where people are supposed to scan their Bus Plus cards, but it's pretty rare to hear the telltale beep confirming that someone's tagged in. There's an innocent explanation for this apparently delinquent behaviour. Some people may have monthly photo cards which are valid whether they're scanned or not, but it's hard to escape the conclusion that Belgrade is a city full of fare dodgers. Why am I so sure of this? Because I've seen what happens when an inspector, or controller as they're known locally, gets on board. In the early days of the Bus Plus system, the controller were easy to spot because they wore uniforms, and as they entered at the front of the vehicle, the bus swiftly emptied through the other doors. These days, the controller wear plain clothes. You can only spot them by the handheld electronic reader all of them carry to check Bus Plus cards, and by the time you've seen that, the inspector is already asking you to present your pass. In some cities, the fare dodger would accept this as a fair cop, but not in Belgrade. People are fully aware that the controller are not police, but employees of the public-private partnership which runs the Bus Plus system. So fare dodgers feel free to ignore the demands for payment of an on-the-spot fine or the production of an ID card. Many of them simply get off at the next stop. The story only changes if the controller are accompanied by police, but usually they're not. These poor officials are about as popular as traffic wardens, but with nothing like the enforcement powers. And it can be a hazardous profession. The police blotter columns in the Belgrade papers record a succession of insults, intimidation, and even assaults on controller. Some refuseniks argue that the Bus Plus contract wasn't awarded transparently, and they're protesting against public money going into private hands. Others say the 75-cent fare is too high for a city where average wages are around 400 euros a month. The controller have little sympathy. After all, paying for public transport is hardly a radical concept. But unless there's a radical change in social mores, Belgrade's bus bandits look set to carry on their free-riding spree.
For Monocle, on the number 8 in Ljubljana and the number 41 in Belgrade, I'm Guy Delaunay.
A report there by Monocle's Balkan correspondent and sometime trolleybus offender, Guy Delaunay. And lastly on today's show, well, I'm not really sure what's going to happen now because the Urbanist producer Carlotta Rabella is joining me in the studio.
Andrew, thank you for bringing me to this side of the glass. It is quite an interesting thing to be able to bring you Urbanist's very own first game show.
Okay, well, I'm not sure I'm going to do very well because I was thinking about this. Obviously, the ambition is to kind of name the sirens from different countries around the world. And I wonder, because they make you jump and they make you move in different countries, but I wonder how much I'm actually attuned to the sounds. So I'm hoping that hopefully there'll be a bit of swagger if it's from like Latin America or, you know, hopefully there's a bit of a musical ambition in them as well, but we'll find out.
So the rules are simple. We'll be playing 6 different emergency sirens from around the world, and Andrew has a list of 12 places, so he has more options than those of the sounds, and we need to see if the travels that he has been doing with Monocle through the years prove to be fruitful and he'll be able to guess the right siren. Let's start with number 1.
Well, I'm going to go with New York. I feel that's quite an American sound. Maybe I'm mistaken, but it feels like the kind of siren that you would hear in a kind of a movie that has a bit of a crisis.
Well, let's hear what the judges say.
Oh, no.
This was an easy one, Andrew. I was starting with the UK. That was London's Metropolitan Police.
This is going to go horribly wrong, isn't it?
Yeah, if you can't guess even the country where we're standing.
Okay.
This is going to be interesting. Let's go to number 2. Now, more melodic, this one. I'll give you a hint if you want. Do you want a hint?
No, I'm gonna have a guess.
Okay, go for it.
France. That's my guess.
Judges?
Oh, no!
Close. It was in Netherlands.
Okay.
Maybe the third one is the lucky one. Let's move over. Now, this time, I'll give you the hint. First up, we're moving outside of Europe.
Oh, please let that be New York.
I don't think this is it. Judges?
Oh, no. So that must be Mexico.
That is Japan.
Oh my gosh, this is like an absolute nightmare.
Well, it might be quite a good sign. It means that you...
I've never been arrested.
Yeah, you haven't been arrested or had to be in an ambulance in any of these nations so far. So just need to pay more attention when you walk around the streets. I'm sure from now on you won't be able to miss them. Let's bring things back to Europe for number 4.
That has to be France, doesn't it?
I'm just going to laugh and let the...
No, I'm going to change my tune.
Okay.
Can it be Spain? Is that Spain? Oh, no!
One more option on this one. It's Europe.
Germany.
Oh. Finally.
Finally. It happened to me right in front of my face and I just... Anyway, carry on.
Let's move over to number 5 now.
I'm going back to France.
Judges?
Oh.
Yes, 2 in a row. And let's wrap up with number 6. I think you'll find this one familiar.
UK again, then.
No, not repeating.
New York.
Judges? Yes, finally.
Gosh.
So, out of the 6 sirens that we had, Andrew got 3 correct. It's a pass. It's a pass, Andrew.
Okay, well, we've had our fun, Carlotta, and you've proved me to be a bit of an idiot, but there is some science behind all of this. To give us a bit of context, Monocle's Daphne Karnesis spoke with Trevor Cox, who's a professor of acoustic engineering at the University of Salford. Trevor specializes in architectural acoustics, signal processing, and audio perception. And he told us why it's important to get the sound of emergency services just right.
I guess when people originally did it, they looked for something that was loud and very distinctive. And I don't expect you do very much different today. So we know the ear is particularly sensitive to a sort of range of frequencies around 3,000 hertz. If I was to scream down the phone, and don't worry, I won't do that to you, that would be the pitch you would head for, or a baby screams at. So that's where the ear is particularly sensitive. So that's the first part of the design, is to make sure you hit that range. And also it has to be really loud, doesn't it? I mean, especially in modern day cars where you can't really hear what's going on outside so well, you need to make sure it's loud enough it can get through the car or into the building so people can hear it.
As annoying as possible, basically.
Yeah, I'm afraid that's probably part of it. You have to have it annoying so it stands out and is prominent. So if you were to have something that was a bit benign and a bit sort of naff, you wouldn't notice it. I think one of the problems you do get if you're near a hospital, let's say, and there's a lot of ambulances going out, there can be sort of noise annoyance problems if every ambulance starts by putting on their sirens as soon as it goes out the door. I mean, I used to stay with a friend in London, which just happened to be down the road from St Thomas's Hospital. And yeah, all through the night, there would be sirens going. So I think emergency services are quite careful nowadays about not using the sirens when they don't have to. But in the end, they have to alert, and it has to be loud enough that people can pick it up. But you're right, it can't be too loud. I mean, it can't be so loud it could cause damage to hearing.
And just sound-wise, how important is it? Should you always be able to tell the difference, let's say, between a police and an ambulance siren, for example?
I'm not sure that's really important from a sort of road safety point of view, because in both cases, what you should do as a driver is the same. I suppose the issue that most people struggle is knowing where it comes from, and that's probably more important than differentiating which vehicle it is.
Do you know historically at all how it's evolved, when the first sirens appeared as a way of warning people in this context of the emergency services?
I guess you'd go back, the sort of earliest warning signals would be church bells. And there's some interesting sort of historical writing about the importance of the church bell to community, but also to alerting the local community to danger. And actually, you had to be, if you're working in the fields, you had to be within the sound of the church bell to kind of be part of the community. So if there was danger, you could be alerted. And I guess that then moved on to early vehicles would have had just simple bells, just hand-rung bells. And then eventually, of course, then it became something more electric, and then it moved on. So that's the kind of, that's the progression that I would know about. But I wouldn't pretend to be a historian of alert signals.
And tell me, why are they different from country to country?
I guess it's probably just a cultural thing. Most of these sirens have been designed by different people, so why should they have a particular sound? I mean, there has been some design work done in Britain where they've looked from a scientific point of view what makes the best siren, but otherwise I guess it's just someone came up with this idea of how to make it, and that's why they just sound different.
And in a way, I guess, because they sound different, you can almost identify a nation depending on the sound of the siren that corresponds to that country.
Yeah, I was Skyping someone in France, and you could hear that really distinctive sort of police siren in the background, and you know you're in France from that kind of, slightly for a Brit, sounds like comical kind of siren they have over there. Yeah, they are very distinctive, and you do immediately know where you are.
Do you think also it's just a matter of you recognise it because you've heard it before? Are there any, I don't know, similarities between the type of sound and the culture of that specific country?
I think that's just entirely learnt from, well, having been in France probably quite a lot, or having watched movies where you've got the French police involved, that you immediately kind of know where it is. I mean, if I heard an American siren, I would immediately know that's from America. And even before I went to America, that'd be true because of all the sort of cop movies or something I'd watched in the past. So I think it's learnt. I don't think there's anything fundamental about these sirens that I know of, which is kind of drawing from the culture. I don't know anyone who's sort of gone, well, I don't know, this would be a very sort of typically British sound. I mean, what would a siren which was typically British sound like? Slightly apologetic, I don't know, saying sorry all the time? I don't know, what would it be?
That was the very unalarming sound of Trevor Cox, who's a professor of acoustic engineering at the University of Salford, and he was speaking with Monocle's Daphne Karnesis. And that's all we have for this week's episode of The Urbanist. The show was produced by Carlotta Rabella, she definitely needs to be locked up, and edited by David Stevens. To play you out of this episode of The Urbanist, here's Inner Circle with Bad Boys. Thank you for listening, city lovers. Bad boys, what you want?
you gonna do? What you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you? Bad boys, bad boys. What you gonna do? What you gonna do when